Session number 17623. Henry Watson, Reel 13.
Mr. Watson, Reel 13, you were talking about the order about the Jewish people in amongst you.
Well, as none of them fancied the idea of leaving all their pals and going to a fresh camp and not knowing where it was or what it was for or whether it was a working camp or anything. So a decision was made by a lot of them that in a nutshell they weren't going to go. So they had all the information they wanted in the office on their documentation, number, rank and name, everything else, trade, profession, everything, and religion. There was a lad in the camp, a South African, who was working in the office, and he was... Well, this was all in with the escape committee, which had been formed then. He would go through these papers and get two or three out at a time and bring them into our hood. Well, there's a lad called Dougie George, a Welsh lad. He was just trying to think of his trade and civilian life. Never mind. He was very good with the pen. And I don't know why, if they knew or not, but the Red Cross used to send in, well, I don't know how many hundreds of bottles of Milton. But there was Milton forevermore. So all you did was you got your bottle of Milton, dab it on the ink, upfloated the ink, take it off with a blotter, there was nothing there. So the names were there, they couldn't alter them. The nationality was there, couldn't alter them. But the religion could be altered, and the profession could be altered. And I got to know one little fella, not by myself, but there's a few of us, Simone, one or two more. We got to know this little Jew boy. He was a Palestinian Jew, and he worked in Haifa in civil life as an interpreter. He spoke seven languages. English was his worst, but he spoke it 10 times better than I could. He spoke English, I speak Tyneside. So little Sammy thought he would work a one on his own. So he gave this guard a bit of chocolate. And he thought the world of that. So little Jew boy started a little... We'll start the turn in here. So he gave him a whole bar. There was one bar of chocolate in every Red Cross parcel. And it was worth having from the barter point of view. He gave it to him and he said, my comrades have collected this. So we'll give him a complete bar, of course. They've each said how much they would give, and we've saved you one bar. That is for you and your wife and your kinder. Oh, great. So that was smashing. What can I do for you? Nothing, says Sammy, nothing at all. They got afraid the next time he come. I want such and such and so and so. Actually, it was some bits for the radio, the... we're wanting of them. verboten. Can't be done. So Sammy just says, right. He says, you signed this, I forgot to mention this, he got this bloke to sign a receipt to say that he'd received this bar of chocolate from this group, you see, as a friendship gesture, and so. He got pulled out, he says, look, he says, I'm going to show this to the commandant. No, he says, die, he says, no, he says, next week he'll be at the Eastern Front. He says, he'll be up in Russia. The bloke was panicking. So I say. So he brought in what were wanted. Well, that was the setting in for, that was the rut setting in for him. He got hammered after that. We tried him with all sorts. We got it. Because we had a thriving black market going there. If you had enough cigarettes and coffee, chocolate, you could buy a Tiger tank. You can buy any damn thing. And that was no use to us, but I had a Luger. And I had it in the tunnel in the theatre. It was out the road. It was a black tunnel. There was no lights in it. And there was Waterloo Stone, and I had it under there. I had no ammunition for it either. It's a good job I hadn't had a contact with. So it's still there as far as I know. So that's the one that I know about that can definitely be proved.
This is altering the religion.
So what he did was he just put the Milton on top of the paint, the ink, lifted it off with a blotting paper, and then this is where his skill was up, where the pen came in, and he put in Sammy, and then in this case, Sammy Eisenbrook, they called him, he put in, he was a London taxi driver. He was that bloody big. Excuse the bad language.
Very small.
A very, very small fella. He put him down as a London taxi driver. And he's Church of England, of course. And never shouted for him.
So the Germans didn't spot this was going on?
No. We took all the Jewish lads out that wandered out. And I don't know of any that went through with it. Because there wasn't many Jewish there. There was one in the 9th, Mickey Harris, the water truck driver. I mentioned him before. So you
in effect saved a few lives that way? Could possibly. And you did infer that other people who, like the chap who was coming in on the railway line that would have gone up to Berlin. Anyone who was in that situation there, Gestapo or someone was showing great interest, you would lose them in the camp.
Oh, Gestapo, if anybody like that, we just lost them in the camp.
How did your radio go then? You obviously got the parts and built it.
Went all right. What sort of question?
I was thinking in terms of it was built very much the same way as your Italian one with the
very much the same
parts coming in.
Only we didn't have anything ready made, but to start and build a lot.
Where did you hide it?
Hide it. There was a place in the proscenium in the theatre. Had a loose board. Sometimes it was there. Sometimes it was in a pack, packed up with clothes, you know, to break up the contours of the thing. And at night time, every night, it was in that little hut at the bottom of the twin huts in the toilet. I used to put my hand down through the hole. And away along to one side, there was a kapook that I'd screwed in. The radio sits in a Red Cross parcel box, a Canadian one, about that square, tied up with string, and another string, a long string, it's a safety string, in my left hand, the set in the right hand, is to pop it down the hole and fish along, holding your nose, woof, till you could get it hooked onto this hook. Try it to see if it was secure, and if it was, then you coiled up your safety string and just put it on the top of the set. And when you took it off, you took the string off first. That's in case you dropped it. If you dropped it, that was it. There's nobody ever going to go down there. So it was there. I didn't have to go out of the hut, because roll call was 9 o'clock or something like that. You weren't allowed out. So we didn't have to go out. Jenny had one or two of the gang watching at different places for anybody coming. But by and large, I stuck to what was said in Italy. If ever we'll get the chance to build another set, we'll keep it dark. Well, there are people today who'll tell you that they had the set. They had it in a chair. They had it in a stool. One bloke who was in our hut says he had it. He had it in an accordion. I didn't make him any wiser. I had the damn thing.
This is the one still in Durham.
No, it wasn't. It's not in Durham, it's here. Never been anywhere else but here. Except once I sent it down to London to my pal, Simo, who wanted a loan of it. So I sent it down to him, and he sent it back to me. So it's there. And it's never been out of my control from the day we made it, the day we started to make it. I've been responsible for it. I've made myself responsible for it all the way through. To the extent that there's out of, I don't know how many hundred in the camp, in the hut, there was 75% of them didn't know where it was. There was just a few that knew. In fact, I had one lad, Eddie Moffat, belongs Hayden Ridge, lives away now. Eddie used to come across to my hut during the day times. And if he landed close on 6 o'clock, and I brought that out, whoosh, he was away. He going like a yo-yo. He doesn't stop to listen to it. He off. He says, you get caught, you will. And he says, I'm not going to be here when you're caught. Anyway, I never got caught.
What was the possible punishment had you been caught?
Well, I don't know. The Italians said that there was no doubt about it, I would be shot. I don't suppose the jury would have shot us, but I didn't want them to find it, just to find that out.
It wouldn't have been pleasant anyway.
But it wouldn't have been pleasant. I'd have had a bloody rough passage for quite a long time. So.
And you've showed it to me then, and it's fantastically clear. How did you get, or how far did you push out the information that you got from the radio?
How far?
Did it go far and wide?
To the whole compound, to the whole of the British forces, 25,000 of us.
How did you do that?
I used to write the information as it came over, down on a sheet of paper, or sheets of paper. We had our own abbreviated longhand. I can't write shorthand, rather. I can't write shorthand. We had an abbreviated longhand. And then we used to copy it out again, in small writing, on some small sheets. And I handed that over to a lad from Bournemouth, Jack. I just forget his surname at the moment. He used to type it out. And he used to read it out to the different huts. No, he used to sneak out from hut to hut after roll call. The 6 o'clock news was the news that we took off every night. And the last person to hear it was after 10 o'clock the next morning. So I hadn't long to wait from 6 o'clock at night till 10 the next morning. For the latest news from the BBC.
And the news was getting better then.
The news was getting better. Everybody's tail was up in the air. That's when the commandant said about the Englishman, the Frenchman, the Dutchman. At the time, everybody had their tail up a bit. Oh, the news is great, eh? We're going to be home for Christmas. You see, we didn't say which one, like, but...
And the importance of your position in the camp was at the centre of communications.
Oh, well, you see, it was a freelance thing. I didn't rely on anyone. And sorry I was, but I hadn't. I used to like a smoke. And near the end of hostilities, I had no cigarettes. And I was clamouring for a smoke. That was by the way. And I needed another 4.5 battery for the LT side of the battery set. So I thought, well, there's only one place I'm going to get anything for that. See, I'd want 25 cigarettes anyway. Or 50. 50, I think it was. It's incidentally, a cigarette is £1 each, the price of them. I would go to the camp office and I saw Snowy Myers, the head man, man of confidence, Canadian warrant officer, Air Force. And I just asked to see him and I went in. What can I do for you, Sergeant? I says, well, I says, you know there's been a radio in the army compound. Yes, he says, I've known a lot about that. I says, do you know who runs it? He says, no. I says, well, I do. I've got it here. Would you like to see it? Good God, no. He says, get the hell out of here with that. What's your trouble? I told him. He says, see, you're carrying a Red Cross parcel. Those hundreds carried Red Cross parcels in case the gut had pinched. There was those who didn't want it pinched, and there was those that they called mossers. I was classed as a mosser because I was often seen walking around someplace with my Red Cross parcel under my arm. He's a bloody mosser, you see. Saving your photo for a booster or to try and escape with, you see. Well, that wasn't the idea at all. I couldn't have eaten what was in the box. And I said, I've got a battery set as well. And I says, and I need a 4.5 flashlight battery for the LT side of it. What do you want a battery set for? I says, well, you know when Jerry knocks the mains off. I says, you've still never gone short of the news, because I says, I just picked the other microphone, earphone up, and took it straight off from the battery set. I had it tuned in, ready. Oh. He says, well, who's been financing this? I says, just me and Simo. Well, he says, why are you not coming to me for? He says, I'd have bought anything you wanted for it. I'd have financed the whole thing for you. I says, no, you tell us, after I've given up 18,000 cigarettes and all my bars of chocolate. I says, I can't help that now, but it just shows you. But I was my own boss. Nobody could dictate to me what they had to do with that set. And I went to the... There again, it's at Durham. I went to the officer, our officer, in the camp and asked him if he would sign us a little chit to say when I was coming home, would they allow me to bring the set home with me? So it was handmade and it had a certain amount of value to me. So I still have that letter and all. And I've got another letter from the South Africans thanking us, me and Simo, for the news service that we'd given all these years and kept the tails up.
How were you able to plug into the mains?
Well, the mains in the camp I switched on. The mains in the camp were in conduit, and there was a cavity above where we slept in the roof of the hut. And the mains ran along the middle of that. So there was a piece of board missing right beside my bed. Nice to keep a lot of the paperwork just up above my head. I climbed up with a knife that I made, and I opened up the conduit on the back side of it, and I selected the two wires that I wanted, the live and the neutral, and I wired them up and just insulated it with paper, pressed the tin back around it, and that was that. The wire was spare. I cut a writ along the joist, at the top of the joist it was, I cut a writ along, and I put the wire right along the joist, covered it over so that he couldn't see it. Of course, it was black dark, of course, but if anybody had gone up with a flashlight. And it came out down through two holes in the joist, right beside my bed, there in that position, was two nails hanging on in the wood. One I hung my hat on, that was the live one. The other one didn't matter a damn. They were all right if he got a hold of one, either one, because you weren't earth. If you got a hold of them both, the wire said, let go and quick. Which he did. And,
did you have any narrow squeaks?
Oh, heavens, yes.
Do you recall any?
Well, one, I had it in me kit, me pack. I had it in there, they saw the shape of the box. And I had it I just shoved it in. I was going to take it away. Sometime in the afternoon, I don't know what I'd been doing, maybe patching up something on it. And I put it in my kit. I thought, oh, I'll just shove these in, shirt and some socks and whatever. And I packed it up till it looked, you know, bulky. And I put it on the heap of kits. And the Jerry came in, and he was feeling all the packs. He got a hold of that. And it was in my mind to go to, click the set of them, give them a kick in the cobblers, and out through the window and away. Or just deny all knowledge of it. Well, the whole hut was going to get wrong then. And he just put it down in time. I wasn't relishing the idea of going gloating them, because if he gets the first known, that's Amadee Duck. But he didn't get it. That was the nearest one I ever had. The Jerry had a hold of it, and he didn't know it. And it was a case of keep going, you beast.
Your heart would be thumping.
Oh, aye.
Did the Germans often punish a hut for an individual's misdemeanors?
No, I think the main trouble, the main thing was he used to chuck you out during the night and search the hut. Put you outside in the cold. And you leave you standing out there for an hour till they had a search around your hut.
Was this for escapes particularly?
Well, for anything like that. If there's any civilian clothing or any, or if they could find a radio. I don't know what they expected to find. Well, they thought they were going to get a big cabinet thing with a speaker in, or what? That could drive a speaker, a loudspeaker. But what was no good putting a loudspeaker on there? Somebody standing at the door is going to hear it, Jerry. So we wired it up so that it only has earphone strength. I could change it, but no way am I going to. It stays the way it was originally.
No, it's a real historical item, isn't it?
Well, I reckon it's not worth five bob, as far as anything goes.
Beyond value to yourself and.
But to me, I wouldn't sell it. It's going into a museum when I'm finished with it.
Have you thought which museum? Put it into?
One of two. In the present moment, the Durham Light Infantry Museum is the favourite. But, bear in mind, I wasn't a Durham. Although, You want to know where I'm... Where
yes,
I'm,
you said it? You said that you weren't at Durham, but the DLI Museum was the favourite for it.
It was favourite because Colonel Sell and I are very good friends, and Colonel Sell has told me that he's going to have me added to the name of the Durhams and to become...
an associated...
Associate member, that was it, of the DLI.
Well, she served basically with the brigade.
It was the only it was the only unit I was ever with, brigade and the 9th. The rest of the time I was in the bag. So I have got an extra feeling towards the Durhams, because whilst I'm a Northumbrian, I was born in Northumberland. My father came from Durham. My mother came from Durham. And both the grandparents, both sides of the grandparents came from Durham. The whole family were all Durham. So I have a bit of an attraction to Durham.
Stalag 4B became famous because of a lady who was actually brought into the camp.
Yes.
Was that, did you know of that at
all? At the time, no. Since then, definitely.
What was the story behind that?
The story behind that was that Mrs. Barrington, as she was called, she had gone, I don't know whether she'd gone across there after the First World War, or he'd been a prisoner of war in England after end of the First World War. Never mind. She got married to this German, and they went to Germany to live. They would have a job there, probably. Now, a son had to be educated, so she sent him to England to be educated. Now then, when the war broke out, he joined the RAF. And I think his father, the German, I think he'd either been killed in the war or died or something. I don't know. There was no record of him as far as I'm aware of. And he went into the RAF and he was shot down. And he came into 4B. Some of the working parties that were outside came back with a word that there was an English woman living in Muhlberg. That's the little village right on the Elbe.